Welcome to the External Medicine Podcast. My name is Daniel Belkin, and I'm here with my co-host and brother, Mitch Belkin.
We're both medical students interested in non-traditional ideas and innovation. This podcast is our attempt to explore topics currently on the outskirts of medicine, topics not widely accepted by the mainstream, but that we believe merit a closer look.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. We do not endorse any healthcare providers or treatments. Our views do not represent the views of any official organization or institution.
If you'd like to support us, follow us on Twitter at exmedpod and sign up for our newsletter at externalmedicinepodcast.com/subscribe.
Today, our interview is with Dr. John Mandrola. Dr. Mandrola is a practicing cardiac electrophysiologist and a regular columnist for theheart.org on Medscape. He hosts the fantastic This Week in Cardiology podcast and is a blogger at drjohnm.org. He completed his medical training in internal medicine, cardiology, and electrophysiology at Indiana University.
In this interview, we speak with Dr. Mandrola about a 2019 article he co-authored called The Case for Being a Medical Conservative. We discuss concerns about vaccine-induced myocarditis in children, vaccine mandates, and whether the AMA and other physician organizations should take sides on controversial political issues. And now we bring you Dr. John Mandrola.
All right. We are here with Dr. John Mandrola. John, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Before we get into the interview, do you have any financial disclosures today?
I do not.
All right. For anyone who's not familiar with your work, how would you describe your background and what you do now?
Sure. I'm a cardiac electrophysiologist, heart rhythm doctor. That means that I pretty much consult within cardiology, take care of patients who have arrhythmias. I typically do ablation procedures, cardiac devices, and then consults on the EP service. And I did that for about 10 years into practice in a private practice setting. And then slowly I got interested in writing and started during sort of that blogosphere period about 10 to 15 years ago, got interested, was fortunate to get picked up by theheart.org, and then really, you know, was really lucky to be associated with the professionals there, editors. Now, you know, a lot of what I do in my spare time is research, and have been able to collaborate with a number of different researchers all over the place, Chicago, my friend Andrew Foy at Penn State, and we're doing some NIH funded research at our hospital with Dan Matlock and his group at University of Colorado. So the research is on my free time, but primarily I'm a doctor. I see patients every day, do procedures. Tuesday, Thursdays are my days in the lab, and then add-ons whenever they come.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started doing podcasting with This Week in Cardiology?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a funny question. When I started writing my blog, I really had no idea how to write. I got a C in English, and I was really, you know, I was terrible at it. And my friends would make fun of me because I'd make all these errors. And so I really studied hard to write. I read every writing book I could find, and I watched videos, and I really worked on it. And I felt like I was getting better. And just at the moment that I got better, my editor at theheart.org said that, John, you really need to start doing podcasts. And I'm like, I don't want to do podcasts. I really like writing. I'm getting better at this, you know? And she says, no, everybody's listening to podcasts. And, you know, it's just at the beginning of when Malcolm Gladwell was getting into it. And I was very resistant at first. And basically it was just, you know, it was just like beginning to write. I had no idea how to do it. And now, you know, thanks to the pros at heart.org, it's done pretty well. And now, of course, I realize that this is how so many people consume content. And it is like writing. I write the script for it in the days before, and I try and use short sentences and action verbs and all that business. So it is both writing and speaking. But yeah, that was the story. I was a naysayer, but now I'm, you know, completely hooked.
A few years ago, you wrote an article in the American Journal of Medicine about being a medical conservative. What is a medical conservative and why do you identify as one?
Well, the first thing to say about that is that it wasn't just I who wrote it. Really, Andrew Foy, he was sort of the senior author of that, and a lot of it was his ideas, and he was just mad one day and wrote out these bullet points, and I said, man, this is really good. We need to write this up. And then Vinay Prasad and Adam Saifu were really intimately involved, and so it was really a project. But basically, and sadly, we wrote this medical conservative sort of approach to medicine before the conservative became such a polarized word. It didn't really, I mean, now people have criticized it and said we shouldn't have used that word because it's, you know, it's so triggering, but it's not really about that. It's really about a number of things. Like, first of all, it's about, you know, having a slow adopting approach, that the sort of Bayesian prior of medicine is that true progress, like magic bullets, like insulin, pacemakers, antibiotics. These things are extremely rare. And many of the things that are sold at these meetings as major advances are really, you know, on that curve, or on the flat part of the curve of value and cost. So that's like the first principle. And the second principle is that, you know, a conservative is someone who's just sort of like Buckley can just stand up and say, hold on, y'all, let's take a closer look at this and really make changes based on evidence. And when the evidence is strong, you don't really need a lot of details to figure it out. I mean, it speaks for itself. And that some of the things that we do dogmatically really end up not being so beneficial. Some people have said, well, this is nihilistic, you know, but medical conservatives are not nihilistic. We appreciate true progress, like the magic bullets. And I think those are the main tenets. I guess one other is that a medical conservative believes that critical appraisal of the evidence is really, really important. And a neutral observer, a person who's expert in critical appraisal, should have a prominent role, because some of the content experts gets not just financially conflicted, but also just intellectually conflicted. And content experts, you know, tend to be enthusiasts for their particular procedure. Like I've been accused of this for this hispundle pacing that I'm so enamored with, and they're like, John, you know, you really need to do trials before you start getting too excited about this. And I recognize that. So we believe that the sort of the neutral observer, the person who's really good at dissecting studies, they're important to have in terms of guiding medical practice.
So you mentioned a curve, and I just want to explain what the curve that you were talking about looks like. So there's this graph which you lay out, which has on the y-axis patient outcomes, and then on the x-axis healthcare spending. And then you draw a logarithmic function starting from zero, and then it goes up very quickly, and then it sort of levels off as you get farther and farther along on the healthcare spending. And then you label different parts of that curve with different types of interventions. I think you put like drinking water, or some vaccines as being very low cost for a lot of benefit for patient outcomes. And then maybe the next section you labeled as hypertensive medications. And then it continues on. And I think you label the last one, one of the things was PCSK9 inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit about that graph in more detail?
Yeah, so I think part of the thing that medical conservatives care about is that curve. And you know, I think it's more like a utility curve. And really the notion is, are the things that we embrace, are the things that we're doing, are they flat of the curve or are they steep part of the curve? And the reason why a PCSK9 inhibitor drug is a flat of the curve type of intervention is that, yes, in clinical trials, there was a statistically significant reduction in cardiovascular outcomes, non-fatal cardiac vascular outcomes. And that is true, but the degree of reduction, the effect size was small, and the cost of this drug is huge. Now, that's not any, that's just the way it is. But the fact is, from a doctor perspective, when we use that drug, we're using something that has a, you know, it's on the flat part of the curve. It's high cost and really a small amount of outcome. Whereas when you make a public health intervention like clean drinking water or childhood vaccine or insulin, I mean, these are insulin, maybe not the best example because it's going to increase the cost, but still those are really huge outcome, have huge effects on outcome. Things in the middle, like PCI for acute myocardial infarction for MI. So that's a pretty high value procedure, but again, it's pretty costly. Many of the things in cardiology today that get late breaking clinical trial status when applied at the bedside are flat of the curve functions. And of course, and this will get some of my colleagues mad, but of course, when we use flat of the curve interventions, that's money spent that we don't have for other things. And I know that gets into the ethics of you know, doctor patient care on an individual basis, but it's just true. And we have to think about that.
So is the medical conservative approach one that thinks mostly about increasing costs for decreasing like benefits? Or is there also an element, I think at the beginning you were talking a little bit about being skeptical of anything new just because it's unlikely based on how many things have been proclaimed to be working in the past for them to work? Or is that something sort of separate?
I think that the medically conservative approach would be to take the frame of reference that proponents of a procedure, proponents of a therapy, the proof is on them to show why it's better than the accepted practice and or a less costly practice. You know, an example in my field of pacemakers are that I've always been, you know, a slow adopter when it comes to new pacing devices and leads. And the reason for that is when new stuff came along that, and pacemaker leads are not tested as rigorously as say a new drug. When I began my practice, we got burned accepting new things. And then people would just get on the bandwagon of this new lead. And then when it works, then we have a lead alert. It's like, holy crap, I wished I was medically conservative. I wished I was a slow adopter of that technology. And so I just think that proponents need to show the evidence of why this is better, why this is what, it's okay to use more costly interventions if they're truly better and create value.
It's interesting that you also bring up how sometimes the biggest proponents are the people that are most aware of the new developments, which puts other physicians in some case at a kind of, I won't say disadvantage, but when you're asking for advice from the content expert who has perhaps a slightly different interest, maybe they have some financial incentive involved in their product becoming more widely accepted. I noticed this myself when I was on a surgery rotation, and frequently, especially on orthopedic cases, there's somebody in the room who's a salesperson that's helping the surgeon with some contraption or other, and they're the content expert. And they benefit by the surgeons using more of their devices. So there's this interesting conflict of interest in the person that has more information on board is also a big proponent because they benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, we write about the dualities of interest, and I think it'd be, I think that my colleagues would, my medical conservative colleagues, we don't oppose this because I mean, you have to have collaboration between physicians and industry. You mentioned orthopedics. I mean, how is the orthopedic company going to iterate their devices without orthopedic input in the same way? How is cardiology? How are we going to get new TAVI valves and new devices? So it has to be collaboration. But in the assessment of the evidence, these dualities of interest have to be considered, you know, and how we adjudicate this evidence. And I don't think it's nefarious. I think it just needs to be, considered in there. But on the matter of expertise and content expertise, I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to like hash out in my Substack is sort of the value of a Martian who would just come down to Earth with none of these biases about this or that, and how would a truly neutral observer who was just good at understanding statistics and trial design, how would he or she approach this? And I get into fights with people, and I'm going to stand by this, but I totally think that content expertise is overrated in terms of assessing the strength of evidence for something. But I know that people disagree with that, but I just think that content expertise just, yes, you know some of the specifics of this and that, but you're also completely biased, not in a nefarious way. It just is.
You're talking about people who would say, hey, you're a cardiologist, not like a virologist or a public health official, or you don't have the proper credentials to weigh in on this or that topic.
Credentials are way, way overrated. I mean, I know that's going to be controversial. And I wouldn't say that credentials are, I wouldn't say they're useless. I mean, they're useful for some things. But they're way overrated. Just take the, you know, one of my takes on the whole COVID intervention thing. Yes, a cardiologist. I mean, I don't know anything about the specifics of viral proteins, and I know very little about epidemiology. But I see 20 patients a day in my clinic, and I see all types. I see conservatives, I see liberals, I see smart people, engineers, I see, you know, farmers, I see all different kinds of people. And as a doctor, you get to understand people. It's your job. And so when there's widespread resistance to one or other interventions to a clinician who sees patients, they're not surprised about this. But to a person who has a different area, then, you know, they I don't know. It's just a different content expertise.
So what are the downsides to medical conservatism as you see it?
Well, I don't think there are many downsides, because I think it's the best of both worlds. I mean, a medical conservative, for instance, you know, take these SGLT2 inhibitor drugs. I mean, the medical conservative approach to SGLT2 inhibitor drugs, which were, you know, began in diabetes, you know, now we have oodles of clinical trials and different types of drugs, strong randomized controlled trials showing reductions in hard outcomes in different patient data sets. So the medical conservative would look at this and say, okay, proponents, you've convinced me that this class of drugs really looks like a good drug. But on some of the other things that we do, take cooling for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. I'm so enamored by this because patient has, I mean, we get involved because, you know, electrophysiology sees patients with cardiac arrest. Person has a cardiac arrest, they get brought into the hospital. The first thing they do is they get put on this cooling bed, patient's shivering, they have to be paralyzed, sedated. And the evidence for this in the beginning was crap. It was terrible. These were methodologically weak studies, but it got accepted as dogma. And just recently, two big clinical trials have come out and showed that this practice that was widely accepted was completely not any more beneficial than a much more conservative standard of care. And so I think those are two perfect examples of a medically conservative approach.
What would you say are the relative pros and cons of being a medical conservative in a novel medical situation, such as like the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think a pandemic, I think the medically conservative approach to the pandemic would have been to, you know, use the precautionary principle early on when there was, you know, just everything was hitting the fan and Lombardy was just in terrible shape. New York was in terrible shape. And there was clearly so much unknown, you know, the sort of precautionary principle would just have been to take aggressive action. But then as things progressed and knowledge increased, I was sort of, I guess there wasn't enough nuance in the discussions. And, you know, somebody would say, well, that's because it got polarized. But I guess I would have, looking back on it, would have appreciated more nuance and more consideration to the, you know, to the unintended consequences of intervention. My granddaughter lives next door, and she did a year of virtual school, and it was just terrible. And she had the support of us. But what about kids who didn't have these kinds of support? And I don't want to make people mad, but I do worry that some of the discussions about the harms of therapy was not as robust.
One thing that was somewhat surprising to me in retrospect early on in the pandemic was how standardized the treatment protocols were when, you know, it was a novel virus, only been around for 4 months, 5 months. And the hospital that I was at, there was, okay, when they get to this oxygenation level, we're going to start them on O2. You hit them with remdesivir. At this point, initially there weren't steroids. Steroids were eventually added on, but it seemed somewhat strange to me. And I think that one could look at this as, well, this is conservative. We're only following the data that exist. We're not experimenting locally. We're doing large clinical trials to figure out what works on a broad scale. And somebody could look at this and say, why are you standardizing protocols before it's really totally evident what exactly works? Why aren't we doing more things? Why aren't we doing more trials?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I don't even think this is sort of the least controversial thing about the COVID pandemic to talk about, is just that early on, things got protocolized and we did stuff and there was very little studies done, and things that we threw the kitchen sink at patients. And I think we now look back on this, and one of the things I hope that will come of the pandemic is that the structure, the value of the randomized controlled trial will have been shown. And that one of the problems that we had was that it would have been difficult to randomize patients. Like in our ICU, we didn't really have a protocol, and it would be nice if we had an NHS like system. And those guys should win a Nobel Prize for this, because I mean, I just think that everything about the recovery trial and what they did in that system was incredible. But yeah, we needed some more medical conservatives to stand up and say, hey, stop, let's think about what we're doing. And because we just did early intubation, for instance. That was just, you know, that I'm sure that did a lot of harm. And again, it's a once in a lifetime pandemic. I don't want to be just a backseat driver. You know, looking back, of course, looking back, everything looks easier. But I was just thinking, we were doing these protocols and giving these drugs that had no proven value. And I was just like, what are we doing? So I completely agree with that. And I hope that's one of the major lessons we learn, is the power of the RCT.
I want to switch over and talk about myocarditis. But before we do, can you just describe what the recovery trial was?
I think the main thing about the recovery trial that I understand. It's been a while since I looked at it, but the main thing is it's this adaptive trial design where they within the NHS system, basically, because it's a centrally controlled system where everybody's linked, is they took the approach that we don't know what works. Instead of just doing X, Y, or Z to patients, we're going to randomize this patient to this treatment and that treatment. And the adaptable design was such that once you showed one thing was beneficial, that became a standard. So when steroids were beneficial, that's what steroids became standard of care arm, and then new things got it added on. And I think the key feature of that trial was its ability to adapt and do different things. I guess that and the central system. And we're not ever going to have that in the U.S., or at least not in my career, maybe not in yours. But I do think that we really need to work on a system of more pragmatic clinical trials.
So now let's talk a little bit about the mRNA vaccines. What do you think of these vaccines, and what do you think of their use in children?
So in many days in clinic, I get into conversations with patients just about how stunning and surprising this messenger RNA vaccines were. I during the pandemic, I was like many a voracious reader of stuff. And of course, I have the Bayesian view of medicine that, you know, true progress is really difficult and magic bullets are infrequent. And then, you know, when these two trials came out, the Pfizer and the Moderna trials came out, and I have a spreadsheet, a Bayesian spreadsheet, and like the Bayes factor, you know, the likelihood ratio that these things are successful had like 32 zeros in it. The p-value is like off the charts. I mean, we don't have things that reduce cardiovascular outcomes by 95%. So it's truly stunning and surprising. And I thank goodness every day that we have these things, and I'm so surprised. So I think it's one of the coolest things in medicine and in my career that these things just vanquished severe COVID and just cleaned out ICUs, cleaned out hospital wards, and I think they're amazing drugs. Now, the thing with COVID is that from the beginning, we knew that there was this age gradient and risk factor gradient, but mostly age gradient. And we know that young kids, it's not zero risk, but it's super low risk. So that's one of the Bayesian priors, is that kids, fortunately, are protected, mostly protected. And then, you know, when the signal of myocarditis came, it was, you know, at first, okay, I don't know what this means. But then, you know, I've looked at the data, and we actually, I have a paper in under review looking at myocarditis cases, and it's clearly a causal signal. And it's, of course, it's a low risk event. But you have to balance this low risk event against the low risk of disease in children. And I guess my take home message is that this balance, this harm benefit calculus has to be considered. And I think it's completely wrong to just say that you know, myocarditis mostly resolves and kids should just get vaccinated, and there's this sort of binary thinking. I think that's what I oppose most, is that I oppose the binary thinking that if you have any concern about this, then you're labeled as an anti-vaxxer. I just think that we need to learn more about why this is happening. And, you know, myocarditis is not Mickey Mouse. I mean, I know most of the cases resolve, but these kids were hospitalized. They had troponin elevations. I mean, big troponin elevations, CRP elevations. And so this is not nothing. And of course, I have, as an electrophysiologist, I see patients with VT who, from scar that came from myocarditis, or we put in devices for patients who have had a cardiomyopathy from myocarditis. So it's just, I just think it needs to be discussed in a non-binary way.
So just to take a quick step back, in terms of the concern for myocarditis after mRNA vaccination in children versus adults, how often is this a serious complication, and how often does this complication even occur?
I mean, I've looked at the data on this, and it at least if you look at VAERS, with all the, you know, VAERS isn't perfect, but I mean, it looks like it's a very small risk of myocarditis in the realm of, you know, over 100,000, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know, 5 to 10 cases per 100,000. But again, that's, I would just say, rather than put numbers on it, I would just say it's an extremely low frequency event. But so is the COVID hospitalization in a child. Now that's number one. Number two, I mean, you ask about how serious is myocarditis. I mean, when you have troponin elevations and you have someone with enough myocardial inflammation to have troponin elevations, we call that cardiac injury. The cardiac muscle has been injured, and it can resolve, and it mostly does resolve, but it doesn't always resolve. And, you know, these kids are told not to exercise for weeks. This is definitely an important illness for the kids that it occurs in. And there's a small but not zero risk of complications from myocarditis. Now, I'm not telling you that, please, nobody cancel me. I'm not saying that there's going to be long-term sequelae from these vaccine-induced myocarditis. But if you have enough cases of myocarditis, a small percentage of those will have long-term complications like VT and heart failure. So it just stands to reason that some of these myocarditis cases may lead to serious complications.
And just to clarify, the VAERS data, that's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System data that you referenced, and I know that we're not going to talk numbers, but that 5 to 10 out of 100,000, was that in reference to total cases of myocarditis or specifically for children?
No, specifically, the way we looked at the data in this paper that's under review is we considered the denominator, the number of kids who got in the number of kids in that age group who got the vaccine. So rather than, you know, some of the things that I want to push back against is if you say the incidence of vaccine-induced myocarditis is X, and then you use as a denominator the total number of doses given to every age group, I don't think that's a fair comparison. You have to, if you're going to use the numerator as vaccine-induced myocarditis cases, you have to use as the denominator the number of kids who've received one and two doses. The other thing to add about this discussion is that people who are concerned about the myocarditis signal aren't necessarily saying that kids shouldn't be vaccinated. What we're saying is that circulating levels of COVID is pretty low. People adults who get the vaccine are protected because of how effective the vaccines are. And there's time to figure out whether one dose might be a better vaccine for kids. The question isn't no vaccines for kids or vaccine, you know, double dose. Why can't we have time to think about one dose or lower doses? Or perhaps in males who seem to be more effective than females when it comes to myocarditis, perhaps a different vaccine for them might be better. So these are all questions that if given weeks to months, we could sort out. But if colleges are going to mandate vaccines for, you know, 19-year-olds and hospitals are going to mandate vaccines and we're going to have vaccine passports, and parents don't have much of a choice. And I guess I'm just asking for people to slow down and think about the trade-offs and potential better solutions.
So what is your opinion on mandates for vaccination in schools and then separately in healthcare facilities?
Well, I'm really the, one of the examples I used in my last column on the heart.org was, okay, you're a hospital. If you mandate, you just say, okay, it's easy. We're going to mandate this and everybody should get this. Then, you know, what about the 18-year-old who works in engineering, who doesn't see patients and just had COVID 2 months ago? Well, okay, so he has natural immunity protection and, you know, he's male. He's in the age group where, you know, myocarditis is in the picture. And now to keep his job, he's going to have to get a vaccine. And I, that's the problem with mandates is, of course, if you're an oncologist or you're, you know, a transplant doctor or you're an ICU nurse, of course, it or any really direct patient care, it makes sense to be vaccinated. It just makes sense. But if you mandate it for everybody, then, you know, that just takes people who've just had COVID or who are concerned about a vaccine and just creates a situation. So I understand the predicament of hospitals and public health professionals, but I worry about these absolute mandates. Certainly in college kids, I think the myocarditis signal in 18 and 19 year olds, I just think this makes it very difficult to mandate vaccines in these kids who may have just recovered are completely low risk. So that's my feeling about it.
I wanted to touch on your relatively recent Substack piece. And in it, you wrote that early in the pandemic, there were few smart people who were skeptical of methodologically flawed science. Can you talk a little bit about this and why you think that was the case?
Yeah, I just think that, like we talked about earlier, one of the main lessons is that during early in the pandemic, I mean, all we had was observational studies, retrospective studies. People would report a number of cases and a certain percentage got one therapy, a certain percentage got another. And then they would come up with this. And if it was in a prestigious journal, then it would stick. And I just thought this was awful that one of the themes of This Week in Cardiology podcast is it's just so difficult making these causal inferences from observational studies. Early in the pandemic, we that's all we had. Now, I have professional friends who, you know, journalist friends will say, John, you know, these observational studies, sometimes that's all you have. But my rebuttal to that is sometimes it's better, no data is better than bad data because it can lead you astray. A good example, I think, for early COVID was this whole notion of anticoagulation. There was a completely flawed paper published in an important cardiology journal that looked at anticoagulation, and it was observational and confounded, but came up with the fact that patients who had full dose anticoagulation did better. And that's, you know, we're learning more and more about that, but then that led to protocols about high dose anticoagulation being initiated. And I thought, this is just crazy. So I think that the notion of being very cautious about making therapeutic algorithms and decisions based on observational studies is one of the main messages of This Week in Cardiology podcast. I just add one thing. I had a very famous professor and fellowship named Harvey Feigenbaum, and he was a sort of the grandfather or father of echocardiography. And, you know, he would just holler at us at echo conference if we would try and call something on an echo, and he would yell at you and just say, if you can't see it, you can't call it. And he would always say, you know, bad data or no data is better than bad data. And so I just think we have to be really careful with flawed observational studies.
You mentioned in this article how scientific journals are beneficiaries of the attention-based economy. So You have a journal published. It gets a lot of attention in the news. It gets cited a whole bunch of times. And then the impact factor of the journal rises. And it's very clear to me that that's bad. You want journals to be rewarded for good data and putting out good research rather than research that gets retweeted a lot. And I was curious if you've thought at all about how we can better align scientific publishing with the correct incentive structure within science more generally.
Sadly, your listeners are going to be disappointed because I don't have a solution to this. I think in medicine, one of the first things that we do as clinicians is identify the problem, and that's important. Make a diagnosis, and clearly the incentives of scientific publication. And I, you know, really for the first 10 years when I was a consumer, only a consumer of scientific evidence, I didn't really realize this, that as I've done more peer review and been involved with this and seen the how the sausage is made, it's just frightening. It is truly frightening how relevant and how influential the attention economy is. I mean, it's talked about in media, regular media, about how, attention brings profits, but it's frightening how journals are affected by this. And I mean, that COVID, not vaccine myocarditis, but that whole myocarditis story in mid 2020, and how flawed those initial studies were, and how subsequent studies didn't bear that out. But some of those early studies that were flawed and attention grabbing, just one of them has almost 1 million page views and hundreds of citations. And I don't know the solution. Some people think about open science and Brian Nosek and his group are working on that, and maybe in your career we'll see something like that.
So you've written in the past that doctors should only be activists as private citizens. Do you still believe this? And if so, why do you believe it?
Yeah, I think that advocacy is clearly, we all have to advocate for what we believe. And I think that's totally fine. My problem with advocacy in medicine is that when organizations say, like, I don't know, the AMA or ACC or something, they come out for one, political view. I mean, there's different approaches to solving a problem. We all agree that income inequity is a problem, but people have different approaches to solving this problem. Some people think that the Bernie Sanders approach is better. Some people think that, more moderate approaches are better. And when a medical organization comes out in one way, how do they represent? I mean, so that's the problem. So I think that advocacy is great. And we should think about it as clinicians. I mean, but we can advocate for it, but as a group, I just think it's difficult. I guess the other thing I would say to your young listeners is that, one of the ways that I'm so happy about being a doctor, and it's so meaningful because we actually can make a difference in people's lives, not just with procedures, but just by caring. So caring is really important. And when we do that, we make the world a better place, and it's meaningful. And I just think that being really good at this craft is something that can make the world a better place. And it isn't easy. And so I think that when you're in training, you have access to all of these master clinicians, and it's so important to get good at being a good doctor, because then you can really Think about all the patients you'll see and make the world a better place. So I guess those are my two main points.
So you're saying that organizations, doctor organization, should not put out, you know, a specific party line on individual issues. Are you also saying that doctors shouldn't be advocates, like let's say on Twitter, as doctors?
Oh, I think it's fine on Twitter if someone wants to come out and let's say you're, I mean, let's just pick gun control, for instance. Let's say you're really a proponent of very strict gun control. I mean, it's fine. It's a free society. Do you know, advocate for that, completely free. But then, you know, well, if the AMA puts out a statement saying they have this feeling about gun control, and 20 or 30% of their members are hunters or whatever who may feel different. I mean, I just think that's problematic. I mean, there is a lot of ways to approach gun violence, and gun control is one, but there are others too. And again, we're doctors. You know, our craft is when patients come to us, they want us to help them with their medical problem. And I'm not saying that social problems aren't important. They are. They need to be considered, absolutely. But we go to medical school, we go to residency, we learn to become radiologists and cardiologists. And I mean, our view about how to fix gun violence, I don't think it's any more valuable than our barbers. I mean, so that's why I think it's fine to advocate. But when you just, you know, when you come out so strongly for that in terms of a medical organization, that's problematic. Consider another example. What if you went to a doctor who had a MAGA hat on and a Trump gear? I mean, that would immediately create tension with some patients. And so I don't know. I think it's fine. But I think we would be better learning to be really good clinicians.
All right, just a couple more rapid fire questions for you. For someone outside the field of cardiology, what are, you know, the top couple of trials that you would recommend that they look up and why?
I think the most important trial, this would be like number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's like, this is the most important trial, I think, in all of medicine. And it's called the CAST trial, C-A-S-T. This is the most amazing story. So the CAST trial, it was published just as I was starting my medical career. And the short story is that when I began cardiology after a heart attack, people just, you know, had their heart scarred and there was no real treatment. And you put them at bed rest and you hope for the best. And then they would have premature ventricular complexes, PVCs. And they would have these premature beats, and the premature beats were a surefire marker that something bad was going to happen. Cardiac arrest was going to happen. And the more PVCs you had, the worse it looked. And so everybody in cardiology believed that we should use antiarrhythmic drugs to suppress these PVCs, because if you suppress the PVCs, you would reduce the rate of risk of cardiac arrest and you would improve outcomes. And it was dogma to suggest otherwise would have been crazy. And then, you know, it just came about, people got gutsy enough to study this. And so they actually did, the CAST trial was a randomized controlled trial looking at patients after heart attack who had PVCs, and one group were randomized to antiarrhythmic drugs, and one group were randomized to placebo, and the drug arm actually had fewer PVCs, but they had a many-fold higher death rate. And so there's so many lessons of CAS, the surrogate outcome being not relevant or not important, the dogma of like treating the surrogate outcome, and the fact that what we were doing was killing people, and to suggest otherwise was impossible until this trial. So it completely reversed a policy of treating these PVCs with antiarrhythmic drugs. And that, to me, to your listeners who want to read one study, this is the most important study, I think, in all of medicine.
What important medical truth do few of your colleagues agree with you on?
I think that what I would say about that is, that's a funny one. I think the weirdest thing about my career and my path in cardiology and in EP is that when we started electrophysiology and ablation, we would burn arrhythmias and patients would be cured, and it was great. It was just so fun. And it's still fun for certain arrhythmias, but then we started burning atrial fibrillation, but we still don't know what causes atrial fibrillation, but no one cares. We just burn it, and sometimes it gets better and we make a lot of money doing it. But then what we've learned, and I think what many of my colleagues would disagree with me on in my field, is that we went into electrophysiology to become these surgical proceduralists. But now it turns out that the things that primary care doctors do, weight loss, exercise, sleep, reduction of alcohol intake, these things have been shown to be like the best elixir for atrial fibrillation there is. And so the paradox is, I went into EP to become a proceduralist. I take care of atrial fibrillation, but 90% of my time in clinic is just talking to people about eating fewer Cheetos and going to bed on time. And it's just crazy. And of course, my colleagues who do procedures, they would say, Mandrola, you know, just do the procedures. And so I think that's the main thing.
Do you avoid lipophilic statins due to their association with dementia?
I don't think the association of statins with dementia is something, I don't discount it. I think it's an unknown. I do, but I just pretty much use high potency statins, and I don't worry much about it. In fact, people ask about it, but I would also make the counter argument that by reducing vascular disease in the brain, you may actually improve cognition. So I don't buy into that.
And with that, thank you so much for joining us on the External Medicine Podcast. If people are interested in learning more about you or your work, where would you have them look?
Yeah, so I guess I'm pretty active on Twitter, and my handle is at Dr. John M, DrJohnM. I have my blog is drjohnm.org, and I have a column at Medscape, theheart.org, and of course, This Week in Cardiology, you can find on Apple iTunes, and of course, I also have a Substack as well, but the Substack is new, and I've just been playing around with it. I'm not sure where that's going yet, but thanks for having me, you guys. It's real fun, and this was great to be with you.
It was our pleasure.
If you'd like to support us, here are some ways you can help. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, preferably a phenomenal review. Visit us at externalmedicinepodcast.com and tell your friends.